Did you know that Nika AATC offers self-paced online courses on a growing range of topics aimed at helping you improve health outcomes for people with HIV? These interactive courses can typically be completed in about an hour and cover multidisciplinary topics such as smoking cessation in people with HIV, geriatric assessment and integration and models of care, managing difficult behaviors in HIV care settings, and using Zoom as a virtual workspace. Self-paced online courses are offered on Rise, Nika AATC's online learning platform. Courses are designed for healthcare providers providing patient care for people with HIV, including physicians, physician assistants, nurses, pharmacists, case managers, outreach workers, and other disciplines. To explore online courses for HIV care professionals, navigate to www.nikaatc.org/rise-courses. That's www.nikaatc.org/RISE-courses, or click the link in the podcast episode description. Welcome to Nika in the Know, a podcast for healthcare providers in the HIV field. I'm Mariana Braitman. Today, I'm sitting down with John Farragon to talk about NPEP, non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis for HIV infection. Welcome again, John.
Yeah, thanks, Mariana. Happy to be here.
So what can you tell us about NPEP today?
Yeah, so I think, we talk a lot about PrEP, right, Mariana, in our programs, and certainly a big piece of what we do for ET, for EHE, ending the HIV epidemic. But sometimes I think we forget about the use of post-exposure prophylaxis for preventing HIV as another option for people for HIV prevention. So for those of you who don't know, non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis is generally, kind of a couple of different categories. Sometimes it's sexual assault, which, obviously is horrible enough to begin with, and then to have to go through some of these strategies for preventing HIV is obviously very traumatic for people. But non-occupational PEP also includes people might have had they might be having consensual sex with somebody, and they might say, the condom broke, or I'm concerned about that I may have acquired HIV from someone because I had a random person that I had sex with, for example. So these are all things that we think about when we think about non-occupational exposure, something that's outside of a healthcare worker who needs post-exposure prophylaxis. But it's been many years since these PEP guidelines were updated. In fact, the last version, I'm just looking back, it's actually 2016. So it's a long time. It's going on nine years now. But here it goes. This is what's currently available. So for non-occupational exposure, there are some things that we just need to be done with regards to assessing people, treating, and then follow up for people who with known or potential exposures to HIV and other infections. And first and foremost, I think that the healthcare providers should evaluate persons for NPEP when care is sought less than 72 hours after an exposure. I think most people that we talk to and most people that do this work will agree that PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis, really is an emergency, and we should be getting it as soon as possible and not waiting to access, especially when you're considering medications. Really the earlier the better. So there's kind of like a risk assessment algorithm that we look at, and if somebody's had a substantial risk for HIV acquisition and it's less than 72 hours for exposure, especially if the source patient is known to have HIV, we're going to almost always recommend NPEP in that recommendation as soon as possible. If the source patient is unknown, it's really kind of case by case determination. But I think oftentimes if the source is unknown, we kind of just, you almost have to assume that they may potentially have HIV. And we do actually put the index patient on, the case that's in front of you, put them on NPEP. If it's greater than 72 hours exposure, the guidelines say that PEP is not recommended. And I think although if it's after 72 hours, I think there is kind of this case by case basis that some people look at. And if somebody, the bottom line, for at least in my mind as a pharmacist And when I get these questions, if somebody is really asking for PEP, even if it's at 96 hours, for example, and they're really, really worried about acquiring HIV, you know, if they're willing to take the meds for 28 days, I think sometimes providers would still probably do it. So for substantial risk of HIV acquisition, what does that actually mean? And examples of this, Marianne, include things like exposure, vaginal, penis, rectum, eye, mouth, or other mucous membranes or non-intact skin, or any percutaneous contact with either blood, semen, vaginal secretions, rectal secretions, breast milk, or any other body fluid that's visibly contaminated with blood. And I think the negligible risk for HIV acquisition is exposure of all those different body parts to with either urine, nasal secretions, saliva, sweat, tears. So those are things that are not infectious. So the point here is to determine the negligible risk versus substantial risk is really determining, does the body fluid contain potentially HIV, and is that a known fluid from the body that actually would be would contain HIV? So urine, nasal secretion, saliva, sweat, tears, those are not going to transmit HIV. However, blood, semen, vaginal secretions, rectal secretions, breast milk is definitely going to be something that would be high risk for acquiring HIV, substantial risk basically in the guidelines. So the other piece to think about is that also just remember, I mentioned this, but just be clear, like for example, if there's spit, for example, and there happens to be blood in somebody's spit, or there's blood exposure in spit, that would be more of a concern because you have blood that's in that fluid. So even though a fluid may not particularly itself transmit HIV, just remember if it's contaminated with blood, we always have to think that there may potentially be an exposure. And I know people don't really think about a lot of this, but I always think a lot about not so much with NPEP, but even with PEP, right? With occupational PEP, those things that I think about when we're having patients who may be working in the ER with patients who may be traumas, for example, and there may be a lot of different body fluids kind of, in a code setting or something like that. So just be aware of that. So I think the point here is that the fluid and the risk of infection is important in this context to kind of decide whether somebody has substantial or negligible risk for HIV acquisition. And that's an important piece for us to kind of assess people when we're trying to figure out what to do.
Can you talk a little bit about what labs should be done in this setting?
So the most important thing is the HIV antigen antibody test, which is the fourth generation test is really preferred. But if it's not available, you know, a rapid antibody test or a non-rapid lab-based HIV test should really be done. If non-rapid testing is done, I think we need to make sure we're starting NPEP immediately and arranging follow-up in 1 to 2 days for HIV test results. If that rapid HIV test is reactive or positive, the person should not be given NPEP, but should be offered immediate antiretroviral therapy before being discharged, and should be linked to ongoing HIV care. Again, because you know that's really a big concern that they actually don't have, they've actually had HIV probably prior to the exposure. In addition, we also have to remember STI testing, so gonorrhea and chlamydia. This is the NAT test, an offer test according to sites of sexual contact, for example, swab, oral, pharyngeal, rectal, and vaginal sites, and then urine for urethral sites. And then for post-sexual assault patients, STI testing should be considered. You know, it's a whole discussion about that, but empiric treatment really should be provided whether or not an STI testing is done. So don't forget about the syphilis test as well, which is the RPR and the VDRL or treponemal test. As you may recall, those numbers are way up based on those 2022 STI statistics, which we covered recently. And also congenital syphilis is way up too. So be sure to do these tests. So that's the congenital syphilis is when it's passed from mom to baby, and that's been a big problem. Also, Mariana, a urine pregnancy test for persons at risk of pregnancy. And again, serum creatinine, some liver function tests, and then obviously your Hep B and Hep C serologies also should be done in the setting of NPEP or non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis.
Now, what about HIV PEP? What exactly is the regimen?
Yeah, so first off, if anyone's listening is really having trouble figuring out what to do and wants help in these cases, just remember that the National Clinical Consultation Center, the PEP line is actually there. There's a 1-800 number, which is 888 448-4911. Actually, if you have our apps that we've advertised, if you have them, if you go to the resource tab in each of the four apps, there's actually a resource tab and you can actually click on the NCC Consultation Center and the phone number will actually come up. So you can actually just dial in that way. And I'll just tell you a quick story real quick. We actually used this line this week. I called this week about a patient, or actually late last week. And so we do this a lot. And sometimes there's questions that we have and we're not sure exactly what to do. And sometimes you get some really good insight from the consultation center. So in answering your question about what's the regimen, I think if rapid HIV testing is negative or if lab-based testing is sent and pending, we do offer NPEP as appropriate. Obviously, STI treatment and then also emergency contraception, which we're not really talking about here, but hepatitis B prophylaxis and HPV vaccination. So for HIV prophylaxis, we try to administer the dose of NPEP on site as soon as possible after a negative rapid HIV test result is obtained, or if a non-rapid HIV test is sent. And the regimens are basically as follows. So it's tenofovir disoproxilfomide, so the older version, TDF-FTC, and then in combination with dolutegravir, which is one tablet of each daily for 28 days. That's the 2016 guidelines. Now, some providers prescribe tenofovir alafenamide FTC in place of TDF-FTC and bictegravir in place of dolutegravir. But please note, this is on some of the AETC guidance and toolkits that are out there, but it is not on the guidelines. So it is on the toolkits as a potential option. There's data, but it's not on any of the on the current 2016 guidelines. And there is some limited data on BFTAF, or some institutions, this may be very cost prohibitive, especially if you live in a state where, like New York State, for example, we're actually required to provide medications at discharge from the ED. So for us to do that, we would never be able to use BFTAF because it's so expensive compared to some of the other cheaper regimens. Particularly FTC TDF is very, very reasonable from a cost perspective. So if a patient is in the first trimester of pregnancy, or they may become pregnant within the first 28 days, again, it's TDF FTC, one tab a day, and then you can either use dolutegravir 50 a day or raltegravir 400 milligrams twice a day. But again, Truvada should not be used for those people who have creatinine clearances less than 60. An alternative regimen must be used in those circumstances. That's important for us to know too.
How does this all compare to what you do at Albany Med Health System?
Yeah, so I think I like what we do at Albany Med. So I thought this would be good for us to highlight. And again, it's not what everybody else does, but it's what we do. First of all, just know that I'm not assuming that we do everything perfect and that exactly the way everybody should. And what we've done here at Albany Med is we provide a 30-day supply to all of our NPEP patients. And the way we've done this is that we've used generic TDF-FTC every day, and then we've used BID raltegravir. Now, this regimen is well-tolerated. It's been out there for a long time. It's been used for many years for PEP. So we have a real good history with it. And the sexual assault coordinators, I think, are really appreciative of the full amount being dispensed. And for those of you who do this work, you know that it's complex, but if you only give patients 7 days, because they have to have a script for the rest of it sent. And sometimes there may be insurance issues. There's also confidentiality issues around potential billing in a pharmacy, potentially, as far as, some patients may see these, parents may see this, for example, that they're somebody was on NPEP in them. So there's a lot of issues around this. So our 30-day policy, I think, has really been helpful. And I know the sexual assault, the SANE nurses that we call them, they often are very appreciative of this. And I will tell you this, when you look at this regimen that I'm talking about, TDF-FTC plus raltegravir, it was actually a lower cost than even doing some of the more expensive options, so even just with 7 days. So even our 30-day regimen is very, very reasonable from a cost perspective and was cheaper than what we used to do for 7 days prior to this. So because generic TDF-FTC, the cost has really come down dramatically, this has really worked well for us here. And I think others may also do this 30-day supply. I think it depends on where you're practicing, et cetera. But, I think I'm proud of what we do at OBMed and the fact that we give out the full 30-day supply to all of our NPEP patients.
Now, what about STIs?
Yeah, so this is an important piece as well. This is for GC, so chlamydia, gonorrhea, and trichomonas, trichomoniasis, impaired treatment. We offer this to all sexual exposures. For GC, it's rocephin or ceftriaxone, 500 milligrams IM times one. It's a gram for persons weighing over 150. So it's a higher dose if you're over 150 kilograms. This is a recommended treatment for GC that should not be substituted with another antibiotic unless there are clear contraindications. And there's treatment guidelines from 2021 that talk about alternatives. For chlamydia, it's doxy, 100 milligrams BID for 7 days. If they're pregnant, it's Zithromax, azithromycin, 1 gram PO times one. If there's a risk of vaginitis, it's metronidazole, 2 grams PO times one. So just know the doxy change was different. It used to be azithromycin for everybody, but because of the rising MICs to azithromycin, to gonorrhea and chlamydia, there was a concern that that would not be the best option. So the rocephin dose, the ceftriaxone dose is higher, and so is the doxycycline now is new and not using azithromycin. Also, other things to think about are emergency contraception. You offer to persons at risk of pregnancy with a negative pregnancy test, hepatitis B prophylaxis, one dose of Hep B vaccine if they haven't been previously vaccinated or incompletely vaccinated. The exposure sources available for testing and is surface antigen positive, unvaccinated, exposed persons really should be given both Hep B vaccine and hepatitis B immune globulin during that initial NPEP evaluation. And then the follow-up dose of hepatitis B should be administered according to the vaccine prescribing information. And then previously vaccinated exposed persons who do not receive post-vaccination testing should be provided a single hepatitis B vaccine booster dose as well. And then prophylaxis against hepatitis C is not recommended currently. I don't know if we'll ever see that in the guidelines, but not right now. And the HPV vaccine for those who are 9 to 45 offer HPV vaccination dose if they're not adequately vaccinated previously. Those are some vaccine issues and some of the STI treatment that we have to think about.
What can you tell us about patient education, side effects, and counseling, things like that?
Yeah. So I think we're in the possible NPEP drug side effects, obviously nausea, GI upset, headache, myalgias, you know, the hand, you know, headache, nausea, and diarrhea. Those are the common ones, but also, you know, myalgias can also occur. Possible NPEP drug interactions. Just be careful of antacids, calcium, and iron supplements. Make sure they're separated out from the integrase inhibitor, unless they're taking it together with food. Providers should also stress the importance of adherence to the NPEP regimen for the full 28 days without interruption. And for those with ongoing risk of HIV infection, make sure we're offering PrEP initiation immediately after the completion of a 28-day course of NPEP. So this is a great important piece because some of this data at 2020 CROI this year looked at this and the whole idea of what they call PEP to PrEP programs, especially for non-sexual assault NPEP. So these are people who've had consensual sex with somebody. They're saying they had an exposure. You give them the 28 days of PEP. They should be really referred to the PrEP program that's linked to your clinic or linked to your hospital or some way somehow link them to a PrEP program so that they can actually get HIV prevention medications if it's appropriate. Especially for the, again, this is for the non-sexual assault, non-occupational PEP cases.
As we begin to wrap up, what else do HIV care providers need to know about all of this?
Yeah, so I think the important piece too is patient follow-up. They really have to make sure that people are scheduled at least within 72 hours probably for their follow-up. And then 4 to 6 weeks after initiating NPEP, you really want to go back and make sure they're retested. We'll likely need additional HIV antigen antibody testing after that initial non-reactive test. Syphilis testing usually at 4 to 6 weeks and then 3 to 6 months after exposure. Hepatitis B and hepatitis C serology testing 6 months after that initial non-reactive test. Again, assuming that they were susceptible at baseline, but I hope this helps. It's a great overview, I think, of NPEP. You know, especially if you go to some of the national websites, there's some great algorithms and great kind of quick cards that you can look at, at least from the ATC that address NPEP. And again, I encourage you to call the National Clinical Consultation Center if you have any help, if you need any help, and you're not struggling on what to do. They're very good at providing assistance around this topic.
John, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about NPEP and what the latest guidelines are saying. We really hope you learned something new today. To learn more about NECA AATC's work and our role in ending the HIV epidemic, visit us at www.necaaatc.org. That's www.necaaatc.org. If you have questions or comments about anything we covered today, or if you have suggestions for topics you'd like to hear us talk about, don't hesitate to email us at podcast@necaaatc.org. That's podcast at nikaatc.org. Stay safe, and we'll see you on Thursday for our next episode of Nika in the Know. This presentation is supported by the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by, HRSA, HHS, or the U.S. government.